hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight inside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me. And that's the name of this program here on LightResistanceRadio.com. Whoa, I like Merle, but I think we'll come back to it later.
I was born
those are actually his sons, Noel and Ben Haggard, and we have time for them on another occasion, but lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, first news, I did mention yesterday that Canadian political prisoner Dr. James Sears is out of jail. He got bail late yesterday afternoon. It was a very hard-fought battle. Yet normally, in a non-violent case like this, I mean, the so-called crime, is writing and editing a satirical newspaper. We're not talking about armed robbery or anything like that. So he's out on bail, pending appeal. The Crown did not want him out. They said he was a very dangerous person. Yeah, maybe they're right, you know. Ideas are dangerous. Far more dangerous than Jack the Ripper or somebody like that. Or they certainly threaten our current corrupt political order. Anyway, he got bail. The Crown did, one of his bail conditions is that he's not to communicate, not to give press conferences or communicate with the media. Now, what else there might be, I don't want to really reveal tactics at this point, but this is not the end of it. Anyway, this is a statement put out earlier today by Leroy St. Germain, who's the owner and publisher of Your War News, and he, Leroy, who is Métis, that's a group of people who are mix of Native Indian and European, will be facing his own sentencing as publisher in a Toronto court tomorrow. We'll be back with you on that. This is the statement that Leroy put out earlier today. Political prisoner Dr. James Sears out on bail. On August 22nd, 2019, a lower court judge unexpectedly sentenced our editor-in-chief, Dr. James Sears, to 1 year in jail for cracking jokes about women and men. Women and Jews. That's what Your War News did. After the judge read out his sentence, Dr. Sears was sworn by guards, one flashing handcuffs. Dr. Sears calmly handed everything in his possession to his wife and four-year-old son, except for his crucifix, which he clutched as the guards handcuffed him and led him off. He was standing tall and beaming with pride. His last words were, "See you guys." But what the lower court judge didn't know is that ever since he convicted us back in January, Dr. Sears has been studying case law. So after spending 5 days in jail on August 27th, 2019, like Jesus, Dr. Sears rose again. He took the paddy wagon from the jail to the courthouse and handed a kick-ass notice of appeal to a superior court judge. Dr. Sears accused the lower court judge of being biased and giving insufficient reasons for convicting us and making other legal errors. The superior court judge agreed with Dr. Sears that his appeal has merit, and she quickly released him on bail pending appeal. He walked out of the court and back into the arms of his wife and son, fresh handcuff marks still on his wrists in the same spot where Jesus was wounded when he was nailed to the cross. One of his bail conditions was to convince me to temporarily take down the Your War News website until the appeal is heard in a few months. I agreed to do it to keep my Christian comrade out of the slammer. I got sentenced on August 29th, and I'll be joining him in an appeal of my conviction and sentence. I'm confident we're both going to win our appeals. When that happens, the website will come back online, and we get a brand new trial. And this time around, we're going to win. This is, I've already privy to some of the defense plans, and this time, they want a brawl. Well, they're going to get one. Here's a great essay by Dan Murray. And Dan Murray heads up a group called Immigration Watch Canada. And they do great research on the immigration question. And this is entitled, "Canadian Politics Controlled by Ethnic Hustlers." Jagmeet Singh and Jenny Kwan, they're both members of Parliament, both members of the Socialist and New Democratic Party. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh and Jenny Kwan. "White racists need to understand that we Asians are the future of Canada." Well, you know, well, if nothing else, they're pretty arrogant. Interesting that they left their failed countries to come here. If they were the future of any country, why didn't they make their own countries better? As Canada approaches a fall federal election, politicians' misunderstanding of immigration's role in Canada becomes more and more ominous. Traditionally, Canada's politicians believed that immigration had to serve the needs and interests of the majority population. That was our policy up until the immigration revolution of 1965. After all, if Canada's politicians did not look after the needs and interests of its majority population, who would? This is my own little editorializing, but with a devil's agreement, though, among the leaders of all the major parties, and initially it was the Liberals and the Conservatives and the New Democratic Party, or the Socialists. As long as there was a gentleman, or maybe villain's understanding, that we won't seriously disagree on immigration, we won't challenge the master plan, which is the replacement of the white people in Canada. That's the master plan. You didn't know that. They didn't tell you. No, of course they wouldn't tell you. It is obvious with each passing year. And equally obvious when you say, well, okay, the demography is changing. At this rate, we will be a minority before 2050, just before 2050. Maybe that's not such a good thing. Maybe we should cut back on this. Oh, we can't do that. Well, if you even notice that we're becoming a minority, you're a racist. This has been a perverse, gentle, villain's agreement up until Maxime Bernier broke the agreement, and his People's Party of Canada is running on a platform, among other things, of seriously reduced immigration numbers. But anyway, back to Dan Murray's essay. However, as Canadians have observed over the past 30 years, prime ministers such as Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, Stephen Harper, and Justin Trudeau have refused to end Canada's high and unnecessary immigration intake. As a result, the interests of recently arrived immigrants such as Muslims, Sikhs, and Chinese, and others have taken priority over the needs and interests of Canada's majority population. In other words, the question the most recent prime ministers have dealt with is not, should we bootleg, but can we get down to bootleg faster than our opponents? All those prime ministers have degraded the prime minister's office and the entire country with their bootlicking. With only 4 years in office, Justin Trudeau has outdone all of his bootlicking predecessors. And contrary to what Trudeau thinks, bootlicking is not something to be proud of. Yes, the prime ministers that he's mentioned, all, for instance, when they went to Sikh meetings, would wear this little napkin-like saffron thingy on their head, like a junior turban. But degrading. Dressing like a clown. Now, that's the way Sikhs may dress. That may be their custom or their religion. But why would you have to ape them? Some people say, well, you couldn't enter a Sikh gurdwara without it. Well, then that becomes the Sikhs' problem. They want the... If I were prime minister, or if any decent, proud European Canadian was, I'd put it to them this way. Look, if you want to hear us, I'd be very glad to talk to you or anybody else. But I'm not playing Mr. Dress-Up. Sorry. You know, if you're prepared to listen to me in a conservative, respectable, dark business suit and white shirt and tie, I'd be glad to speak to you. If you expect me to dress up like a clown, no way. But, of course, these prime ministers have. And Dan Murray continues, as for MPs, most people who aspire to become one have abandoned the traditional idea that immigration should serve the interests of Canada and its majority population. For example, the contrast between the nationalist immigration views of the NDP's founder, well, actually, it was the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation's founder, and they were the party that preceded the NDP, but anyway, Reverend J.S. Woodsworth. And the contrast between the ideas of Reverend J.S. Woodsworth and the NDP's recently elected Jagmeet Singh and other NDP MPs such as Jenny Kwan is one of many examples of how disgraceful politicians' behavior has become. Singh is an ethnic Sikh and Kwan is an ethnic Chinese. Their primary loyalties are to their ethnic groups, not to Canada. Their primary goal is to increase the numbers of their groups through high immigration. Kwan demonstrated that several months ago in her role as NDP's immigration critic when she led a charge to remove health restrictions on immigrants. Essentially, Kwan argued that if a potential immigrant is sick, Canada should not prevent that person from entering Canada. In her view, such a practice would discriminate against sick people. That view is one that NDP founder Reverend J.S. Woodsworth and traditionally NDPers would have vehemently opposed for the very obvious reason. Why buy ourselves health costs? If Canadians get ill, well, okay, they're ours, we have to take care of them. But why bring in more people who are sick? That just doesn't make any sense. Kwan went even further. She spoke in favor of a new law that establishes every April as Sikh Heritage Month. To most Canadians, the biggest heritage that Sikhs have in Canada is the bombing of Air India, an incident that killed 329 Canadians. Why is this group, whose members are responsible for the largest mass murder in Canadian history, to be honored? If anything, they should rot forever in Canada's Hall of Shame. Or, as Ricky Ricardo used to say when very frustrated by Lucy on the I Love Lucy's show, you've got some splaining to do. Kwan may have heard Woodsworth's name, but she definitely knows little about the traditions bequeathed by Woodsworth and the early NDP to her political party into Canada. Woodsworth was a Canadian patriot who was very proud of Canada's founding French and UK settlers. Woodsworth revealed his nationalist outlook about immigration in his 1909 book entitled Strangers Within Our Gates. This is something that Jenny Kwan said. White supremacists have no right to complain about Chinese millionaires controlling the real estate market. Get used to it. Vancouver now belongs to the Chinese. Well, Andy Herview. Like the current NDP leader and many NDP MPs, Kwan has probably never even heard of Woodsworth's book, let alone read it. In her most notorious statement as an elected politician, she defended Chinese immigrant entrepreneur tax evaders when she said, the Chinese are very private about their money. Well, I was actually told the same thing by a Chinese woman who ran for the party, the Reform Party, as it began to morph into the Conservative Party. And she ran in Mississauga. I even tried to help their campaign a little bit. And it was called the Canadian Alliance. And she said, well, one of her platforms was to roll back a proposal that was would require taxpayers to indicate any foreign money, foreign income or foreign holdings. Well, she said Chinese people do not like to reveal their finances. None of us do we? Why should they be special? But Jenny Kwan said, when some legislators discussed a law to make Chinese millionaire immigrants pay their fair share of taxes, Kwan said, this law against Chinese tax evasion goes against our culture. Well, yeah, that may be true, Jenny, but this is Canada. It's our rules, our backyard. Well, at least it should be. As for Singh, in his acceptance speech as the new NDP Socialist Party leader, he virtually declared that Canada's two founding groups have no right to be in Canada. In his contempt for Canada's majority population, Singh has obviously alienated NDP donors and probably tens of thousands of traditional NDP voters. In fact, Jagmeet and his clawing and grasping Sikh supporters in their crude grab for power may well turn the NDP into dog meat in the fall election. Jagmeet himself could well become dog meat. I think Dan, you stole that line from me. But anyway, yes, and my prediction is that the 40 or so NDP seats will be cut in half. Jagmeet Singh will lose almost every seat, if not every seat, in Quebec. That will take remove about 16 members from his caucus. The great hopes of picking up Sikh-dominated seats in Brampton and North Mississauga, in Surrey, and one or two other places across the country, I don't think will come to pass, because I think the overall Sikh leadership will back the party that gives them the best chance of power, the one that's in right now, the traitor Liberals. So I don't think they'll pick up seats, and they will be reduced very likely to the hardcore of old line NDP seats, a few in British Columbia, a couple in Manitoba, one perhaps in Saskatchewan, a few in Northern Ontario. They're the party that chose him. So, in his 1909 book, Reverend J.S. Woodsworth foresees that immigrants are becoming a political force, and that their interest in getting the franchise and in voting will make them a stronger force in the future. He quotes American researcher Preston F. Hall on immigrants' impact in the United States, and Hall said, the heterogeneity of these races tends to promote passion, localism, and despotism, and to make impossible free cooperation for the public welfare. Trudeau and other politician bootlickers should take special note of Woodsworth's support of Preston. What Preston and Woodsworth are saying is that diversity is not the strength of immigrant-receiving countries. In fact, it's a significant societal weakness, which leads to passion, that's violence, localism, that's the triumph of local tribal concerns over national ones, and despotism, that's an overall lack of social cohesion. In addition, Woodsworth is saying that the lack of social cohesion can lead to the breakup of countries who currently allow extremely foolish and naive high immigration intakes. I think it's a very, very well-written essay. This is another little journey through history, and it's also written by Dan Murray, and is anticipating this coming Monday, which will be Labor Day. And Dan writes, Labor Day 2019 is the 112th anniversary of the 1907 Vancouver Parade. The 1907 arrival of many low-wage laborers precipitated the September 1907 Vancouver riot. usually presented to historically uninformed Canadians as a no-racist riot. For many years, our media, politicians, and our immigration industry have used these incidents to tell Canadians how terrible the Vancouver's population's attack upon were on Vancouver's Chinatown and Japantown in early September 1907. All at the same time, they have contrasted the people of 1907 with today's people and suggested that the people of Vancouver are more enlightened today, thanks to the wonders of multiculturalism and mass immigration policies, or basically the near occupation of our country. If anyone were to ask those who are saying these things where they were getting their information, 99% would have to admit that they were merely repeating what they'd been told by Canada's immigration industry and ethnic groups. So let's look at what really happened. Let's start by asking one important question. Was there any connection between the unexpected arrival of about 11,500 Japanese, East Indian, and Chinese in 1907 and the 1907 Vancouver Labor Day riot? Maybe? Yeah. There's clear evidence that there was. Before the riot, British Columbia had a complaint to Ottawa about the numbers of new arrivals in 1907. Sensitive to riots against whites in China, not long before, and for which whites had been compensated, Ottawa listened. Not long after the Vancouver riot, Ottawa sent its Deputy Minister of Labor, Mackenzie King, who would eventually become Prime Minister, Mackenzie King, to Vancouver to conduct a royal commission to determine how much compensation should eventually be paid to, one, the Japanese, and two, the Chinese, whose property had been damaged. While King was doing his work, Ottawa asked him to conduct another royal commission, which would investigate why about 11,500 Japanese, Chinese, and East Indians had arrived in the first 10 months of 1907. The population of Vancouver was about 60,000. Now keep that in mind. 11,000 people, or a little more than a sixth of the population of the city, arrives from Asia in 1 year. There might be a problem here. The population of Vancouver was above 60,000 at the time, and an inflow of 11,500, a sudden population increase of almost 20%, most of whom arrived before the riot, would have been very noticeable. The Chinese in parts of colonized China did not want cultural and economic invasion. Neither did the majority population of British Columbia in 1907. In Mackenzie King's words, the influx of 8,125 Japanese alone had, quote, naturally caused great alarm, and if anything more were needed to occasion unrest, it was found in the simultaneous arrival from the Orient of Hindus by the hundreds and Chinese in larger numbers than in preceding years. Now, back then, Indians, whether they were Muslim or Sikh or Hindu, were generally called Hindus instead of Indians. In Mackenzie King's words, according to Dr. James Morton's book, The Sea of Sterile Mountains, about 30,000 of Vancouver's 60,000 people participated in the parade through Vancouver streets that preceded the riot, an indication in 1907 of significant Vancouver support for an end to cheap labor. And that's why complicit capitalists sometimes turn the blind eye to this. They thought, cheap labor. Obviously, many people at the time believed that the measures that Ottawa had taken in up to 1907 were not having the desired effect of stopping the importation of cheap labor and the unfair employment competition it caused in the labor market. Chinese labor contractors were the key in the importing of Chinese laborers up to 1907. Almost all Chinese laborers in China could never have afforded to pay transportation costs to come to Canada. So the Chinese contractors paid them in much the same way as snakeheads pay the fares of Chinese illegals today. Although Canada and Japan negotiated gentlemen's agreements with the help of the Japanese consul in Vancouver to restrict Japanese labor inflows, China was in such political chaos that it was difficult for Canada to negotiate such agreements with the Chinese government. Canada therefore took unilateral action, particularly head taxes, against Chinese labor contractors to discourage them from importing Chinese laborers. This was done because the Chinese represented the majority of the cheap labor. Now, what a head tax was it had to be paid by or on the behalf of the immigrant before that person was allowed into Canada. Oh, that's so terrible, people wail today. That was racist. Well, no, it was to try to keep out cheap labor. And this will be explained, but a $500 per head tax was a very considerable amount of money in 1907, when a dollar a day was widely believed to be a white man's pay. So that'd be over a year's wages. Well, you can be sure that the labor brokers, who, if they put such money up, would basically rent the Chinaman out as cheap labor and seize most of his wages. Among the measures to restrict Chinese laborer inflow was the Chinese laborer head tax. Note that the term Chinese head tax is incorrect. The term should be Chinese laborer head tax. Chinese businessmen and their families, Chinese students, and consuls were exempt from the head tax. The first significant head tax was $50 in 1886. Next was the $100 tax introduced in 1901, and finally the $500 tax in 1904. Prior to 1904, Chinese business contractors had imported most of the Chinese laborers from China. But individual Chinese also became involved in 1904, from 1904 on. When the $500 head tax was imposed, Chinese contractors began to find that there was no longer much profit importing these laborers and obtaining work for them. The result was, in the three-year period immediately following the imposition of the $500 head tax, very few Chinese laborers came to Canada. With the drop in Chinese laborers, a Japanese immigration company, the Canadian Nippon Supply Company, saw a business opportunity. The problem was that its opportunity would undermine the measures that Ottawa had put in place to deter cheap Japanese labor. Without telling Ottawa, this company arranged with the CPR to import over a period of time between 500 and 2,000 Chinese laborers to work in the CPR's Western Division, which at that time employed about 5,000 workers. CPR was the Canadian Pacific Railway. And then, as now, significant elements in big business were only too complicit in trying to bring in cheap labor to undercut white workers to keep unemployment high and wages low. They were economic traitors to their nation, and that's where you have to have strong government to prevent that. The newcomers would represent a significant part of the entire Western CPR, or Canadian Pacific Railway's, workforce. All the Japanese would be paid less than Canadian workers and would probably be displacing higher paid workers, you think? The Nippon Supply Company also secretly arranged to import about 500 Japanese laborers to work in the Dunsmuir family's coal mine on Vancouver Island. These Japanese laborers would also be paid less than their white counterparts. Rumors about these deals had circulated in 1907. Were confirmed only during Mackenzie King's Royal Commission investigation after the riot. There's no question that the rumors were a major concern reason for the high turnout in the parade. There's no question that BC worker frustration with this issue, which had been built up over many years, was also a factor. In response to the frustration, which had started in the late 1800s, the British Columbia legislature had passed a large number of laws to curb Asian cheap labor, but almost all were disallowed by Ottawa, because, of course, there was an immigration matter. because almost all the Asians in Canada at that time were located in British Columbia, MPs and officials in other parts of Canada who were isolated from the issue and found it hard to understand what British Columbians were complaining about. In Mackenzie King's role as the Deputy Minister of Labour, he stated clearly that although there were other minor reasons for the conflict, the major factor in the conflict between the locals and Asians was the economic advantage Asians had in the labor market. Laborers' wages in Canada were considerably higher than those in Japan and China or India. For example, at cheap labor wages in Canada, which contractors had set precedents for in the 1880s, and which cheap labor employees readily agreed to, Japanese laborers received 10 times the wage they were paid in Japan, Chinese laborers 20 times, East Indians about 50 times. Most Asians came to Canada as sojourner males, in contrast to the many married local laborers. Sojourners were the equivalent of temporary foreign workers. Most wanted to make as much money as possible quickly. They also lived very frugally and sent money home. Most did not intend to stay. In 1901, the Royal Commission report on immigration, many British Columbia residents testified that they'd been displaced from work and knew of many other locals who had been forced to leave as well. Others complained that many potential married settlers had been discouraged from coming to British Columbia because of the low-wage labor. A so-called better life, the cliched phrase used today by our immigration industry to sanctify and justify high immigration levels, really meant a worse life for Canadians displaced from their jobs in that era. There were several important results of Mackenzie King's inquiry. One was that his investigation confirmed what the very extensive Royal Commission report of 1901 had uncovered. That 1901 Royal Commission had heard much talk of Chinese laborers being brought here by Chinese labor contractors. However, there was little evidence about how the Chinese labor contractors operated. The evidence King gathered Canadian Nippon Supply Company provided a picture of how the Japanese contractors worked, and probably also a fairly good picture of the methods of the Chinese who had worked in the shadows for over two decades. It also showed that the contractors were involved in a very profitable business. In fact, some of the richest Chinese businessmen in Chinatown were involved in, wouldn't you guess it, labor contracting. King's inquiry demonstrated the chaos in Canada's immigration system in 1907 and how labor disputes in far-off Hawaii could affect Canada. At that time, there were between 50 and 60,000 Chinese agricultural workers in Hawaii. Facing a cut in wages in Hawaii, thousands of Japanese laborers were encouraged by shipping companies and others to leave Hawaii for supposedly greener pastures in Canada and the mainland United States. Mackenzie King concluded that if thousands more were to do the same thing, the potential for extremely serious conflict with the resident population in Canada was great. This is because there was clearly not enough employment for those who had arrived, nor was there sufficient accommodation. King pointed out that even those who had been indifferent to Asian immigration were alarmed at the problems the sudden high inflows had caused, like, you know, overcrowding. One of the major results of King's investigation was that Ottawa enacted continuous passage legislation, which required any Japanese who wanted to come to Canada to come directly from Japan. Even before this law was approved, it was illegal for Japanese who had been permitted to travel to Hawaii to travel from Hawaii or from any other place which Japan had allowed them to go to without the permission of the Japanese government. So this could be an important pressure point. Mackenzie King's meticulous investigation showed that 6,398 of the 88,125 Japanese who arrived in Canada in 1907 had come from Hawaii. The remaining 1,650 had traveled from Japan. Of the 1,650, 900 were imported by the Canadian Nippon Supply Company, that's a Japanese labor contractor, and another 750 were returning to Canada or coming as immigrants approved by the Japanese consul. Of the total of 8,125 Japanese who arrived in 1907, About 3,500 would soon leave for the U.S., while about 4,500 remained in Canada. The illegal immigration from Hawaii, the scheming of the Canadian Nippon Supply Company, and the 1907 riot, which resulted from the scheming, were major international embarrassments to both Canada and Japan. To compensate for the corrupt and underhanded actions of its citizens, Japan quickly agreed to Canada's continuous passage law that required that people coming from Asia, particularly Japan, had to come directly from their country of origin, not from some place like Hawaii along the way. The Japanese government quickly conceded that this law was intended to protect Canadian laborers and that there was ample justification for such a law. The law would later be applied to the East Indians aboard the Komagata Maru, which is a Japanese flight ship, but which had picked these people, people mostly Sikhs, up in India. This law would later be applied to the East Indians aboard the Komagata Maru, which tried to challenge the law in 1914, but lost. The loss has been met with shrill, unjustified claims which failed to look at all the immigration conflict which preceded the Komagata Maru incident. The most significant and damning thing that can be said about the current interpretations of the 1907 Vancouver parade and riot is that they were clearly wrong. In spite of this, they have long been used to elicit guilt from Canadians and subsequently to perpetuate unjustified high immigration levels. One positive thing that can be said about the federal government in 1907 is that it did try to correct its mistakes. Unfortunately, the same thing cannot be said today. Many elected officials at all three levels of government are doing nothing to correct the major blunders of Canada's immigration policies of the past two decades. So we have two questions. Who are the enlightened in the debate over the 1907 immigration chaos and the Vancouver riot? The people of 1907 or the people of today? Two, will it take events similar to those of 1907 to get a large number of current elected officials to pay attention to the immigration-related complaints of many Canadians? That definitely seems to be what will be necessary. Now, I was in a H&R Block outlet in the office in a small town in southern British Columbia this morning, accompanying a friend of mine on a tax matter. And as we waited for the appointment to see the tax consultant, I noticed there a sign very similar to ones I'd seen all over a hospital in this part of British Columbia yesterday. And it advised that, violence, aggressive language, swearing, etc., would not be tolerated, and furthermore, that any such action could result in the person being ejected from the office or even charged criminally. That means depending on the behavior. I thought, this is insulting. I mean, this sign glaring me at eye level as I sat there in the H&R Block office waiting to for the consultant to come and see my friend. Oh, look, this is incredibly rude. Who are you talking to? You know, you're talking to adults. What are you saying? So I asked the receptionist there, is this type of sign necessary? I mean, it's so insulting. I'm an adult. I don't like to be hectored at. I'm not creating a disturbance. And the receptionist seemed to think it was quite odd objection. Well, she said, sometimes people swear and so on. Well, maybe sometimes people have a right to swear. I don't know. But certainly any violence, you don't have to have a sign to tell me you must not be violent here. Well, clearly not. You shouldn't be violent anywhere. And if you are, well, people may call the police and bad things will happen to you. But as an adult, I don't need this. So I was talking later on to the consultant, who also seemed quite genuinely taken aback that I'd be offended. Well, I was told, there's a lot of crime here. There perhaps is. But most of the people coming to your H&R Block office are not criminals. And then she said, well, you know, there's all sorts of sealant. There's, you see, there are a lot of transients through this area, fruit pickers and so on. Some of them are not the best type of people. And I don't doubt there is theft. And I said, you know, the only supermarket in town has all sorts of signs. You've got to take your backpack off, leave it with a friend outside, etc. I said, you know, it will come to the point where the only way you're acceptable to the owners of that company will be for you to shout bare naked. I mean, let's throw it at them. She said, well, you know, there's a lot of theft. I said, yeah, there may well be. But most of us are not thieves. Why should we be treated as thieves? Well, she said, you know, the police don't do much about it. It's very small stuff. Now, there we begin to get to the problem. She even said, volunteered that the local, I don't think it was, I think it was Goodwill, but anyway, one of these outfits that collects money for the poor, had even had some of its merchandise stolen by some of these transients. And she said, the police don't do anything. I said, no, they're probably too busy out trying to catch speeders, you know. That revenue, you know, let's be quite clear about it. That's what it is. It's revenue. There isn't much revenue there used to be cold hot dogs within easy reach of shoppers in that particular supermarket. But they've been removed because so many of them were just out in the store. Okay, now I'm sympathetic to a store. The margins in the grocery business are tight. They don't want a lot of their goods stolen, and that makes perfect sense. But you see, the problem is, we're told the police won't do anything. But that's the problem. And that's why Canadians have become so whipped and passive. I make a point. You know, I don't like signs insulting me. And I would make the point, if there was any competition in that town, I would not go to a store that gratuitously insults me. On a completely different issue, back where I've lived in Port Credit, some of the local supermarkets are charging 5 cents for a plastic bag. That's to save the environment, don't you know? But some of the smaller stores, like one of my favorite Italian groceries, doesn't. You got a free shopping bag. Well, that's where I patronize, and I've made it clear to the supermarkets that, you know, short of absolute desperation, I will not shop there because you insult me. Yeah, you treat me like, quite frankly, an asshole. You're going to make decisions for me. I'm an adult. If I wanted to walk around with a burlap bag, thinking I'm saving the planet, that's my business. I know there are many people who do. I think they're silly, but that's their business. But you're not going to make that decision for me. Canadians have got to speak up to the corporate bullies, and they are, you know, because it's easier. Just say everybody will have to be, you know, you have to leave your or large purses or backpacks outside. Why should I, you know, have to go in half naked in order to shop and spend my money in your grocery store? You know, I think if more people put it to them that way, they might start leaning on the local police to do their job, which is to enforce the law. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio .com. I'm going to play some songs from some of our friends in Southern Africa, and this is the a song for the 100th anniversary in 1989 of the British South Africa police force, which played a big role in of course in South Africa and in the early days of Rhodesia. So this is the British South African Police Force on a song commemorating their 100th anniversary in 1989. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
Less of these ends.
I think we have to find a way to suppress this ad, and we're on our way. And this is the BSAP with John Edmund.
in 1889, her regiment was born, and her mounted troopers rode in sunshine and in storm, from Bechuana land to the mighty Zambezi. Known by many names, she was the BSAP. Come ye troopers of old, wherever ye may be, drink a century toast to the BSAP, and we'll sing a couple of bars of the good old Kamakai song. To the BSAP, and the regiment lives on. She has served in war and peace, had glory and has bled, a multi-sided role in the land where she was bred. The guardian of the country, she was always there, like that trooper that was molded on the Morris Depot Square. Come ye troopers of old, wherever ye may be, drink a century toast to the BSAP, and we'll sing a couple of bars of the good old Kamakai song. To the BSAP, and the regiment lives on. Old black boots may march on, reservists may grow old, and far too might have done their very last patrol. Last body on his beat, last airman in the sky, last bee girl on the radio, the legend cannot die. Come ye troopers of old, wherever ye may be, drink a century toast to the BSAP, and we'll sing a couple of bars of the good old Kamakai song. To the BSAP, and the regiment lives on. The outposts of the world, the regiment lives on. In the land of the silver fern, Australia and Hong Kong, in Britain's misty isles, beneath American skies, in Africa, her birthplace, the spirit never dies. Come ye troopers of old, wherever ye may be, drink a century toast to the BSAP, and we'll sing a couple of bars of the good old Kamakai song. To the BSAP, and the regiment lives on. To the BSAP, and the regiment lives on.
One of the most exciting things in the White Rhodesian fight in the Bush War was a brave attack by the Rhodesian Air Force on a terrorist base in Zambia. And this is actual
these are the thoughts
recording of the
that run through the sky,
the squadron leader attacking.
He is a man, a very special kind. Our wings are a fortress to our land. Today, a special mission's planned. Dear land, today I'll serve thee well. My motherland has gone through hell. No one in the world to heed her. Tomorrow the world will know green leader. Fight anywhere and everywhere. Speed and courage and a prayer. Seek and strike, strike from above. Do it for the ones you love. And as our sections now deploy, a minute to run seek and destroy, swift to support men and machines, aspire to achieve our dreams.
And this was a song called The Last Word in Rhodesian. It's got it's very kind of clever wording, clever lyrics. And the last word in Rhodesian is Ian. Ian, of course, was Ian Douglas Smith, the Prime Minister through the entirety of Rhodesian independence. This is The Last Word in Rhodesian is Ian. This is Paul Frost. There's another one of those Air Canada ads. I'm all snuck in here. Okay, the last word in Rhodesian.
R is for the regiments who fight the winning fight. H is for the home fires that the folks are keeping bright. O is for the other ranks and officers as well. And D is for the diehards who believe in fighting hell. E is for the enemy that just won't ever win. S is for the spirit of our men that won't grow dim. I is for the independence that we have to share. And A is for the arms that we will always have to bear. And the first word in Rhodesian is Rhodes. That's a name that everybody knows. It may be as Rhodesian as the flag of white and green, but the last word in Rhodesian is Ian. R is for the regiments who fight the winning fight. H is for the home fires that the folks are keeping bright. O is for the other ranks and officers as well. And D is for the diehards who believe in fighting hell. E is for the enemy that just won't ever win. S is for the spirit of our men that won't grow dim. I is for the independence that days for the arms that we will always have to bear. And the first word in Rhodesian is Rose. That's a name that everybody knows. It may be as Rhodesian as the flag of white and green, but the last word in Rhodesian is dear. And the first word in Rhodesian is Rose. That's a name that everybody knows. It may be as Rhodesian as the flag of white and green, but the last word in Rhodesian is in. The last word in Rhodesian is in.
That's the last word in Rhodesian. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Thank you.